faintly. "Tell me he's alive?" She couldn't bear any more tragedy today. Not one more ounce.
"He's alive, but he had a stroke," Beatrice whispered. "Although they've stabilized him, they don't know how much damage was done. He's still unconscious. I'm going back to the hospital in a few minutes. The nurses insisted I get a breath of fresh air."
She flushed.
"I couldn't stop crying. I guess I was pretty loud and the doctor was getting upset with me. I thought I'd get some soup and tea before I went back for the night, so here I am."
She waved a hand at the plastic container of soup and sandwich to go.
"Oh, Beatrice, I'm so sorry,"
Gwen breathed.
"I don't know what to say."
Tears she'd been holding back slipped down her cheeks. Tears for Drustin, and now tears for Bea and Bertie.
"Dearie, are you crying for me?" "Oh, Gwen!"
Slipping over to Gwen's side of the booth, she hugged her, and they clung to each other for a long time. And something inside Gwen broke. Wrapped in Beatrice's motherly arms, the pain of it all crashed over her. How unfair to love so deeply and lose! How unfair life was! Beatrice had only just found her Bert, much as Gwen had only just found Drustin. And now were they both to suffer endlessly for losing them?
"Better not to love,"
Gwen whispered bitterly.
"No,"
Beatrice chided gently.
"Never think that. Better to love and lose. The old adage is true. If I never had another moment with my Bertie, I would still feel blessed. These past months with him have given me more love and passion than some people ever know. Besides," she said, "he's going to be all right. If I have to sit by his bed and hold his hand and yell at him until he gets better, then tote his ornery butt to the doctor every week and learn how to cook without fat or butter or a damn thing worth eating, I'll do it. I am not letting that man get away from me."
She fisted her ring-bedecked hand and shook it at the ceiling.
"You can't have him yet! He's mine still!"
A bit of laughter escaped Gwen, mingled with fresh tears. If only it were so easy for her. If only she could fight for her man the way Beatrice could fight for hers. But hers was 5 centuries dead. She became aware, after a moment, that Beatrice was regarding her intently. The older woman cupped Gwen's shoulders and searched her gaze.
"Oh, dearie, what is it? It looks to me as if you might be having a problem of your own," she fretted.
Gwen tucked her bangs behind her ear and averted her gaze.
"It's nothing,"
she said hastily.
"Don't try to put me off,"
Beatrice chided.
"Bertie would tell you there's no point once I set my mind on a thing. It's not only my problem with Bertie that's made you cry." "Really?"
Gwen protested.
"You have enough problems." "So take my mind off them for a moment, if you will,"
Beatrice pressed.
"Grief shared is grief lessened. What happened to you today? Did you find your, cherry picker?"
Beatrice's blue eyes twinkled just a bit, and Gwen marveled that the older woman could still sparkle at such a moment. Had she found her cherry picker? She fought a bubble of nearly hysterical laughter. How could she tell Beatrice that she'd lived almost a month in a single day? Or at least she thought she had. It was so strange coming down from the foothills to find that no time at all had passed. She was beginning to fear for her sanity. Yet Beatrice was right. Grief shared was grief lessened. She wanted to talk about him, needed to talk about him. How could she possibly confide her pain? Unless...
"It's really nothing,"
she lied weakly.
"How about if I tell you a story instead, to take your mind off things?"
"A story?" Bee's eyebrows disappeared beneath her silvery curls.
"Yes. I've been thinking about trying my hand at writing,"
Gwen said.
"And I've been kicking around a story, but I'm stumped on the ending."
Beatrice's eyes narrowed thoughtfully.
"A story, you'd say? Yes, I'd like to hear it, and maybe you and I will be able to figure out how the ending should go."
Gwen took a deep breath and began.
"Okay.
The heroine is a girl who was hiking in the foothills of Scotland, and she found an enchanted Highlander sleeping in a cave above Loch Ness. Pretty far out there, huh? An hour later, Gwyn watched Beatrice open her mouth several times, then close it again. She fussed with her curls, fiddled with her hat, then smoothed her pink sweater.
At first, I thought you were going to tell me something that happened to you today that you didn't want to own up to.
Beatrice shook her head.
But, Gwyn, I had no idea you had such an imagination. You truly took my mind off my worries for a time, goodness,
she exclaimed, waving at the plastic containers.
Long enough that I ate when I was certain I wouldn't be able to force a bite down. Dearie, you must finish this story. You can't just leave the hero and heroine hanging like that. I can't stand it. Tell me the end.
What if there is no end, Bea? What if that's all of it? What if she got sent back to her time and he died and that's it? Gwyn said numbly.
You can't write such a story. Find a way to bring him through the stones.
He can't, Gwyn said flatly. Ever. Even if he lived.
Oaths are a lot of nonsense when love's at stake,
Beatrice insisted.
Bend the rules. Just write that rule out.
I can't. It's part of the story. He would become a dark druid if he did. And Gwyn understood how awful that would be better than most ever could. Not one of his clan has ever broken the oath. They must not, and in truth I'm afraid I would think less of him if he did. Beatrice arched a brow.
You might think less of him?
Gwyn shook her head sheepishly.
I meant my heroine in the story. She might think less of him. He was perfect the way he was. He was a man of honor who knew his responsibilities, and that was one of the things she loved about him. If he broke his oath and used the stones for personal reasons, he would corrupt the power within him. There's no telling how evil he would become. No. If he lived, which I greatly doubt, he will never come through the stones for her. You're the storyteller. Don't let him die!
Beatrice protested.
Fix this story, Gwyn,
she said sternly.
How dare you tell me such a sad story?
Gwyn met her gaze levelly.
What if it's not just a story?
She said softly. Beatrice studied her a moment, then glanced out the window into the twilight. Her gaze shifted from left to right, over Loch Ness in the distance. Then she smiled faintly.
There's magic in these hills. I've felt it ever since we arrived, as if the natural laws of the universe don't quite apply to this country.
She paused and glanced back at Gwyn.
When my Bertie gets better, I might just take him up into the hills myself, under a good doctor's care, of course, and rent a small cottage for the rest of the fall. Let some of that magic soak into his old bones.
Gwyn smiled sadly.
Speaking of Bertie, I'll walk you back to the hospital. Let's go see what the doctors can tell us. And if you need to cry, I'll do the talking.
Although Beatrice put up a token protest, Gwyn didn't miss the relief and gratitude in her eyes. Gwyn was relieved, too, because she suspected she might not be able to bear being alone for quite some time. Gwyn spent the rest of her holiday in the village by the deep, glassy loch with Beatrice, never looking up into the foothills, never venturing forth from the village, never allowing herself to even consider going to see if Castle Keltar still stood. She was too raw, the pain too fresh. While Beatrice visited Bertie at the hospital, Gwyn huddled beneath the covers, feeling feverish with grief. The prospect of returning home to her empty little apartment in Santa Fe was more than she could bear to contemplate. When Beatrice returned in the evenings, exhausted by her own worries, they comforted each other, forced each other to eat something healthy, and took slow walks beside the huge silvery mirror of Loch Ness, and watched the setting sun paint the silvery surface crimson and lavender. And beneath the wild Scottish sky, Gwyn and Beatrice bonded like mother and daughter. They tossed around her story on more than one occasion. Beatrice urged her to write it down, to turn it into a historical romance, and send it to a publisher. Gwyn demurred.
It would never get published. It's way too far out there.
That's not true,
Beatrice had argued.
I read a vampire romance this summer that I adored, a vampire of all things. The world needs more love stories. What do you think I read when I'm sitting in the hospital, waiting to see if my Bertie will ever be able to speak again? Not some horror story.
Maybe one day,
Gwyn had conceded, mostly to end the conversation. But she was beginning to consider it. If she couldn't have the happily ever after in real life, at least she could write it. Someone else could live it for a few hours. Despite her relentless grief, she refused to leave Beatrice's side until Bert was stable and Beatrice in better spirits. Day by day, Bert grew stronger. Gwyn was convinced he was healing from the sheer magnitude and depth of Beatrice's love for him. The day he was released, Gwyn accompanied Beatrice to the hospital. His speech was impeded because the left side of his face was paralyzed, but the doctor said that in time and with therapy he might regain considerable ground. Beatrice had said with a wink that she didn't care if he could ever speak clearly again, as long as all the other parts were in good working order. Bert had laughed and written on his erasable memo board that they certainly were, and he'd be happy to demonstrate if everyone would quit fussing over him and leave him alone with his sexy wife. Gwyn had smiled and watched with a mixture of joy and pain as Beatrice and Bert rejoiced in each other. Only after they'd wrung a promise from her that she would visit them in Maine for Christmas. Beatrice had indeed rented a lovely cottage on the loch for the fall. Did Beatrice help Gwyn pack up and tuck her into a cab for the ride to the airport? As Gwyn settled into the back seat, Beatrice shifted her ample bulk into the door and hugged her fiercely, kissing her forehead, nose, and cheeks. Both were misty-eyed.
"Don't you dare give up, Gwyn Cassidy. Don't you dare stop loving. I may never know what happened to you that day up in the hills, but I know it was something that changed your life. There's magic in Scotland. But always remember, a heart that loves makes magic of its own."
Gwyn shivered.
"I love you, Beatrice, and you take good care of Bertie," she added fiercely.
"Oh, I plan to," Beatrice assured her.
"And I love you, too."
Beatrice stepped back as the driver closed the door. Once the cab pulled away from the curb, and she'd watched Beatrice until she was a small, pink-clad speck in the distance, then gone, Gwyn cried all the way to the airport. October 20th, present day. Chapter 26. Although Gwyn had known by the age of 4 that objects derive color from their innate chemical structure, which absorbs certain wavelengths of light and reflects others, she now understood that the soul had a light of its own that colored the world too. It was an essential light, the light of joy, of wonder, of hope. Without it, the world was dark. Didn't matter how many lights she turned on, everything was flat, gray, empty. Sleeping, she dreamed of him, her Highland lover. Waking, she lost him all over again. Most days she hurt too much even to open her eyes. So she stayed in bed in her tiny apartment, drapes pulled, lights off, phone unplugged, reliving every moment they'd spent together, alternately laughing and crying. On rare occasions she tried to persuade herself to get out of bed. Short of bathroom jaunts to attend a queasy stomach, or stumbling to the door to pay the pizza guy, it wasn't working. She was mortally wounded, but her stupid heart kept pumping. How was she supposed to live without him? She'd been deceived by platitudes and clichés. Time did not heal all wounds. Time didn't do a damn thing. Truth was, time had stolen her lover away, and if she lived to be 100, heaven forbid she suffer that long, she'd never forgive time. "That's silly," the scientist sniffed. Gwyn groaned, rolling over on her side and pulling a pillow over her head.
"Leave me alone. You've never been any help to me. You didn't even warn me that saving him would make me lose him." "I tried to. You didn't want to hear me, and I'm trying to help you now," the scientist said stiffly. "You need to get up."
"Go away."
"You'd better get up unless you want to sleep in that 3-day-old slice of pizza you just ate."
Well, that was one way out of bed. a shaking Gwyn decided a few moments later as she weakly brushed her teeth. Seemed to be the only way she got up lately. Squinting, she braced herself before turning on the light so she could see to wipe off the toilet. The light hurt her eyes, and it took her several moments to adjust. When she caught a glimpse of herself in the mirror, she gasped. She looked awful. Her hair was dull and tangled, her skin pale, her eyes red and swollen from crying. Her face looked gaunt, her eyes defeated. She really needed to get herself together, she thought dimly.
If not for you, then for the child,
the scientist agreed.
What?
Her voice, so long unused, cracked, and the word escaped in a hoarse, disbelieving croak.
Child! The child, you idiot!
The scientist snapped. Gwyn gaped, stunned, staring at her reflection. She peered at herself for a long while, brows furrowed. Shouldn't her skin look radiant or something if she was pregnant? Shouldn't she have gained a little weight? She glanced dubiously down at her flat stomach, flatter than it had ever been in her life. She definitely lost weight, not gained.
Don't tell me you can't do the math. When's the last time we had our period?
Gwyn felt a tiny bud of hope blossom in her heart. She squelched it firmly, a dangerous feeling, hope. No way. She was not going that route. She'd hope she was pregnant, only to be doubly crushed when she found out it wasn't true. It would destroy her. She was in bad enough shape already. She shook her head bitterly. The scientist was wrong this time.
I'm not pregnant,
she told her reflection flatly.
I'm depressed. Big, big difference.
It was simply stress making her period late, nothing more. It had happened before. During her great fit of rebellion, she'd skipped two periods.
Fine, so crawl back in bed, keep eating stale pizza, and refuse to wonder why you've been getting sick. Blame it all on stress, and when you lose our baby because you won't take care of yourself, don't blame me. Lose our baby?
She gasped. Fear knifed through her, and her eyes flew wide. If there was even a remote possibility that she had a child of Druston's inside her, there was no way she was losing it. And afraid though she was to hope, because of how awful the potential disappointment might be, she acknowledged that there was more than a possibility. There was a probability. They'd made love repeatedly, and she was not on birth control. If she hadn't been so lost in misery, she might have considered it sooner. If she was pregnant and did anything to jeopardize the baby, she would just die. Stricken, she stumbled back into the bedroom, turned on the light, and took a good look around, thinking hard, counting days, looking for clues. Her bedroom was a pigsty. Pizza boxes with half-eaten slices dotted the floor. Glasses with milk-encrusted bottoms were forgotten atop the bed table. Cracker wrappers were strewn across the bed, crackers she'd been nibbling in the morning to calm her queasy stomach.
Oh, my God,
she whispered.
Oh, please. Oh, please, let it be true.
The wait to discover if she was pregnant was interminable. No at-home pregnancy test for Gwyn Cassidy. She needed to hear whatever news it was directly from a doctor. After giving both a urine and blood sample, Gwyn tapped her foot and sat tensely in the crowded waiting room of her doctor's office. She felt wired from head to toe. She shifted position a dozen times, changed chairs, fanned through every magazine in the office. She paced, periodically made sure the receptionist knew she was still alive. The receptionist scowled each time she passed by, and Gwyn suspected the woman thought she was mildly unbalanced. When Gwyn had called earlier, nearly hysterical, insisting on seeing the doctor immediately, the receptionist had brusquely informed her that Dr. Carolyn DeVore had no openings for several weeks. Gwyn had pleaded and sobbed until finally the frustrated receptionist had put Carolyn on the phone. Her dear, wonderful doctor since childhood, who'd become a friend over the years, had squeezed her in.
Sit!
The receptionist snapped, exasperated, as Gwyn paced by again.
You're making the other patients nervous.
Mortified, Gwyn glanced around at the room full of people and slunk back to her chair.
Miss Cassidy?
A nurse poked her head around the corner.
That's me!
She shot back up and trotted after the nurse.
That's me,
she informed the receptionist brightly. A few moments later, she took a seat on the examining table. Hugging herself in the chilly room, she sat, feet swinging, waiting. When the door opened and Carolyn DeVore stepped in, Gwyn said breathlessly,
Well?
Carolyn closed the door, smiling.
You were right. You're pregnant, Gwyn.
I am?
She breathed, scarcely daring to believe it.
Yes?
Truly?
She persisted. Carolyn laughed.
Absolutely, and unequivocally.
Gwyn hopped off the table and hugged her.
I love you, Carolyn,
she exclaimed.
Oh, thank you.
Carolyn laughed again.
I can hardly take credit for it, but you're welcome.
For several minutes, all Gwyn could do was repeat,
I'm pregnant,
a delighted smile on her face.
You need to gain weight, Gwyn,
Carolyn chided.
I squeezed you in this afternoon because you sounded so awful on the phone. It worried me.
She paused as if searching for a delicate way to continue.
I know you lost both your parents this year.
Her brown gaze was sympathetic. Gwyn nodded tightly, smile fading.
Grieving takes its toll.
You're 10 pounds lighter than you were at your last checkup. I'm starting you on supplements today and putting you on a special diet. It's fairly self-explanatory. But if you have any questions, call me. Eat. Feel free to stuff yourself. Go overboard for a while.
She gave Gwyn a folder of menu suggestions and a bag of sample supplements to tide her over until she went to the drugstore.
Yes, ma'am,
Gwyn promised.
Scout's honor. I'll gain, I promise.
Will the father be helping you?
Carolyn asked carefully. Gwyn took a deep breath.
I am strong,
she told herself.
My baby is depending on me. He died.
The word escaped in a soft rush of air. Merely saying it hurt her to the marrow in her bones. 500 years ago, she didn't say. Carolyn would have packed her off to a cushy, padded hospital if she said that.
Oh, Gwyn,
Carolyn exclaimed, squeezing her hand.
I'm so sorry.
Gwyn glanced away, unable to meet Carolyn's sympathetic gaze. Simple kindness could undo her, make the tears come. Carolyn must have sensed it, because her voice changed, became briskly professional again.
I can't stress enough that you must gain weight. Your body is going to need special care, and I'd like to schedule an ultrasound.
An ultrasound? Why? Is something wrong?
Gwyn was alarmed, and her gaze flew back up to Carolyn's.
No, nothing's wrong,
Carolyn hastened to assure her.
In fact,
she added, smiling,
depending on your outlook, you might think it's something wonderful. Your HCG levels lead me to believe you're carrying twins.
An ultrasound will give us a definite answer.
Oh, my God, twins?
Gwyn cried.
Twins,
she repeated disbelievingly. Twins just like Druston and Dagus. A chill raced through her. Not just one of his babies, but two.
Oh, Druston,
she thought, lanced by piercing sorrow.
Twins, my love.
How he would have rejoiced in the news, how he would have celebrated the birth of their children. But he would never know, would never see his sons or daughters. She would never get to share this with him. She closed her eyes against a wave of pain. Carolyn watched her closely.
Are you all right, Gwyn?
Gwyn nodded, her throat tight. After a long moment, she opened her eyes again.
If you need to talk, Gwyn.
Carolyn trailed off, waiting. Gwyn nodded stiffly.
Thank you, but I think it's just going to take some time.
She forced a weak smile.
I'll be fine, Carolyn. I'll take care of myself, I promise.
Nothing would jeopardize her babies.
I'll squeeze you in again on Friday,
Carolyn said, walking with her to the door.
I'll have my receptionist call you this afternoon with a time.
Gwyn thanked her profusely.
You have no idea how much I needed to know this.
Carolyn gazed at the dark circles beneath her eyes.
I think I do,
she said softly.
Now, go home, eat, and take care of yourself.
There's more than just yourself to think about now.
Gwyn waved goodbye to the receptionist as she left. She was pregnant. She had a part of Drustan inside her, a child of his, possibly two, to raise, to love, to cherish. Walking across the parking lot to her car, she was briefly stunned by how blue the sky seemed, how bright the sun, how green the grass. Color. There was light in her soul again. Chapter 27. A week later, Gwyn was back in Scotland. She sat at the base of the McKelters Mountain, perched on the hood of her rental car, gazing up, filled with trepidation. When Carolyn had confirmed she was carrying twins, a surge of energy had flooded her. She'd cleaned her apartment, put the phone back on the hook, gotten her hair trimmed, treated herself to an eyebrow waxing, and gone grocery shopping. Then she'd called Allstate to tender her resignation, only to find they'd already fired her for not showing up for so many weeks. No loss there, she'd shrugged philosophically. She'd called a realtor and placed her parents' house on the market. The ostentatious show place had been paid off years ago, and the sale of it would give her more than enough money to make a fresh start. She was done with Santa Fe, done with insurance claims, done with it all. She was thinking of moving to the East Coast, maybe Maine, near Bert and Beatrice. She'd buy a lovely house with a darling nursery, perhaps get a job at a local university teaching math and making it fun. But before she could do any of that, before she could move forward, she had to somehow make peace with the past. And the only way to do that was to lay to rest the questions that drove her mad at 3 o'clock in the morning when her heart felt heavy and her soul was inclined to brood. Questions like, had Drustan died from the arrow wound or survived? And if he'd survived, had he ever married? She hated considering that one because it left her feeling so torn. She would be crushed if he had remarried. Yet at the same time, she would be crushed if he'd spent the rest of his life grieving. She loved him so much that if he'd lived, she wanted him to have been happy. It hurt her to think he might have grieved for 30 or 40 or 50 years. She realized that she was the lucky one. They'd both lost each other, but she alone had the precious gift of their babies. More questions. Had Dagus had children? Had any McKelter descendant survived to the 21st century? The answer to that question could be a blessing, for if McKelters still lived above Alborath, she would feel as if they hadn't failed completely. One of the things Drustan had wanted was to ensure the future succession of his clan, and if by saving Dagus they had guaranteed survival of his clan, she could find some small measure of satisfaction in that. Even more than finding answers, however, she needed to go sit by his grave, to lay sprigs of heather atop it, to tell him of their children, to laugh and reminisce and weep. Then she would go home and be strong for their babies. It was what Drustan would want. Steeling herself, she slipped back into the rental car. She didn't delude herself. She knew that whatever she found atop the mountain was going to be excruciating, because this was going to have to be the final goodbye. As Gwyn topped the crest of the mountain, her eyes misted. The perimeter wall had been torn down, and the majestic stones of Bandrocade towered against the brilliant cloudless blue sky. There she had made love with her Highland mate. There she had traveled back into the past. There she had become pregnant, according to her due date. She'd known that seeing the stones again would hurt, because a part of her was tempted to hole up in a laboratory and try to figure out the formulas that danced so far beyond her comprehension. The only thing that held her back was that Gwyn knew, even as brilliant as she was, that she could devote the rest of her life to it, only to die a bitter old woman, never gaining the knowledge. She would not live her life like that, nor would she subject her children to it. The few times she'd pondered the symbols, she'd realized how far beyond her understanding they were. She might be a genius, but she just wasn't smart enough. Nor would she plead, if modern McKelters still lived, with them to break their oaths and send her back, and unleash a dark druid upon the world. No, she would be the woman Drustan had loved, honorable, ethical, loving. Thus resolved, She accelerated past the stones and lifted her gaze to the castle. She sucked in a breath. Castle Keltar was even more beautiful than it had been in the 16th century. A sparkling, many-tiered fountain had been constructed on the front lawn. It was surrounded by a lush tumble of shrubbery and flowers and stone walkways. The facade had been renovated, probably many times over the centuries, and the front stairs were no longer stone, but had been replaced with rosy marble. An elegant matching marble banister framed both sides. What had once been a huge wooden door was now double doors fashioned of burnished cherry trimmed with gold. Above the doors, a stained glass window detailing. Her heart leaped. The McKelter plaid shimmered brilliant purple in the sunlight. She parked before the steps and sat gazing at the door, wondering if that small bit of McKelter heritage meant the castle was still inhabited by descendants. Suddenly the door opened, and a young child, blonde curls tumbling about a delicate face, stepped out, peering at her curiously. Inside the rented Volvo, Gwyn squinted against the bright sunlight at the lovely little girl, who was followed closely by a boy of similar age and an older pair of twins. The eldest boy and girl took her breath away and eradicated any question in her mind about whether any descendants had survived. They most certainly had. Pure McKelter blood was apparent in both of the older children, in the rich dark manes, the unusual eyes and golden skin. The boy could have been Dagus's own son, with similar golden eyes. She closed her eyes briefly, fighting tears, feeling both joyous and sad. They hadn't failed completely, but the visit was going to be excruciating, she realized, massaging her temples.
"Hello,"
the little girl called, knocking on the car window.
"Will you be getting out, or will you be sitting in that old D?"
Gwyn snorted lightly, the pain easing a bit. She opened her eyes and smiled. The little girl was absolutely darling, peering in expectantly.
"You're going to have two of those soon,"
a comforting voice reminded her.
"Gotta! Get back from that car!"
A blonde woman who looked to be in her early 30s called, hurrying down the front steps. She was heavily pregnant, and Gwyn instinctively touched her own abdomen. Turning off the ignition, she tucked her bangs behind her ear and opened the car door. She realized as she stepped out that she'd not thought this far ahead. She had no idea what excuse she would offer for dropping in on perfect strangers. She would have to play it by ear, claim to be taken with the castle, then beg a tour. She was grateful that the woman was pregnant, because she was willing to bet she would invite her in to visit without asking too many questions. Gwyn had recently discovered that pregnant women were a breed unto their own, with a tendency to forge an instantaneous, deep bond. A few days ago, she chatted for over an hour with a pregnant stranger in the ice cream aisle of the grocery, discussing baby clothes and tests and methods of birth and all kinds of things that would bore a non-pregnant person silly.
"I take it these lovely ones are yours,"
Gwyn said, offering her friendliest smile.
"Aye, my youngest are Cory and Kara,"
she said, gesturing toward them. Kara said hello again, and Cory smiled shyly.
"And these,"
she waved a hand at the dark-haired teenage twins,
"are Christian and Colleen."
They chimed hello together.
"Plus, I've two on the Wii in a few months,"
Maggie added.
"As if it weren't obvious,"
she said dryly.
"I'm pregnant with twins myself,"
Gwyn confided. Maggie's eyes flickered strangely.
"'Tis easier that way,"
she said.
"You get them over with two at a time, and I always wanted a dozen or so. I'm Maggie McKelter, and my husband should be out in a moment."
She turned to the steps and shouted,
"Christopher, do hurry! She's here!"
"Coming, love,"
a deep baritone voice replied. Gwyn frowned, puzzled, wondering what Maggie had meant by, "she's here." Had they mistaken her for someone else? Perhaps they were expecting someone, she decided. Maybe they were hiring a nanny or a maid, and thought Gwyn was that person. Kara tugged impatiently at Maggie's arm.
"Mama, when are we going to show her?"
Kara began.
"Hush,"
Maggie said swiftly.
"Run along with you and Cory. We'll be in shortly. Kristen, you and Colleen go help Mrs. Melbourne lay the tea in the solar." "But, Mum, do I have to repeat myself?"
"I'm going to have to clear up this case of mistaken identity,"
Gwyn thought, watching the children go in. She didn't care for the thought of misleading Maggie McKelter. Then all thought fled her mind as Maggie's husband, Christopher, stepped out of the castle. Gwyn sucked in a breath, feeling suddenly faint.
"Aye, the resemblance is strong, isn't it now?"
Maggie said softly, watching her. A dark lock of hair fell over Christopher's forehead, and he had the same extraordinary height and muscled body. His eyes were not silver, but a deep, peaceful gray. He looked so much like Drustan that it hurt to look at him.
What do you mean?
Gwyn stammered, trying to compose herself.
I mean he looks like Drustan,
Maggie replied. Gwyn opened her mouth, but nothing came out.
Like Drustan? What did they know about her and Drustan?
Och, Gwen Cassidy, Christopher said with a thick Scots burr. We've been waiting for you for some time now.
Smiling, he slid his arm around Maggie's waist. They both stood there, beaming at her. Gwyn blinked.
How do you know my name?
She asked weakly.
What do you know about Drustan? What's going on here?
She asked, her voice rising. Maggie kissed her husband's cheek, slipped from his embrace and tucked her arm through Gwyn's.
Come in, Gwyn. We have much to tell you, but I think you might be needing to sit while you're hearing it.
Sit,
Gwyn repeated dumbly, her knees feeling weak.
Good. Sitting would be good.
But sitting didn't happen, because the moment Gwyn entered the Great Hall, she froze, gaping at the portrait that hung above the double staircase facing the entrance. It was her. 6 feet of Gwyn Cassidy, clad in a pale lavender gown, blonde hair tumbling about her face, graced the wall at the landing between the two staircases.
Me,
she managed to say, pointing.
That's me.
Maggie laughed.
Aye, it was painted in the 16th century.
But Gwyn didn't hear the rest. Her attention was caught and held by the family portraits covering nearly every inch of the walls in the Great Hall. From ancient times to modern day, they stretched from chair rail to ceiling. Eager to see who Dagus had married and what kind of children he'd fathered, she hurried past the modern paintings. Dimly, her mind registered that Maggie and Christopher were trailing behind her, now watching in silence. At the section displaying the 16th century, Gwyn drew to a stunned halt. She stared for a moment, unable to believe what she saw, then smiled as tears misted her eyes. She fancied she could hear faint strains of Sylvan's laughter in the air, and Nell making some saucy response, the patter of children's feet on stone. The painting that held her captivated was 8 feet tall, a full-length portrait. Nell was seated on the terrace. Sylvan was standing behind her, his hands on her shoulders. Nell held twins in her arms.
Nell?
She finally said, turning to look at Maggie.
Aye, the lot of us descend directly from Sylvan and Nell McKelter. He wed his housekeeper, so the records say. They had 4 children. We have twins, an uncommon lot in this family. He looks pretty old to be having kids to me,
Colleen said, wrinkling her nose as she bounded back into the Great Hall, followed by her siblings.
The tea's ready,
she announced. Gwyn's heart swelled.
He was 62,
she said softly. And Nell hadn't been a spring chicken either. Dear Nell had gotten her babies back after all, and it had been Sylvan who'd given them to her. She moved to the next portrait, but 2 empty spaces followed. The wall was darker where portraits had once hung.
What was here?
She asked curiously. Had they taken down portraits of Drustan to give her? Christopher and Maggie exchanged an odd glance.
Just 2 portraits being touched up,
Christopher said.
There's Nell and Sylvan again,
he said, pointing farther down the wall. Gwyn eyed them a moment.
And Dagus? Where is Dagus?
She asked. Again the couple exchanged glances.
He's a mystery,
Maggie finally said.
He wandered off somewhere in 1521.
Is there no record of his death?
No,
Maggie replied tersely.
How very odd,
Gwyn mused. but she would come back to that later, for now thoughts of Drustin consumed her.
"Do you have any portraits of Drustin?"
"Mom!"
Colleen cried.
"Come on, you're killing me! Let's get on with it!"
Christopher and Maggie grinned.
"Come. We have something more for you."
"But I have so many questions,"
Gwyn protested.
"How do you—"
"Later,"
Maggie said gently.
"I think we need to show you this first. Then you can ask whatever questions remain."
Gwyn opened her mouth, shut it again, and followed. When Maggie stopped at the door to the tower, Gwyn took a slow, deep breath to calm the racing of her heart. Had Drustin left something for her? Something she could give her children from the father they would never know? When Maggie and Christopher exchanged a loving glance, she nearly wept with envy. Maggie had her McKelter. Gwyn longed for some small token to remember hers by. A plaid with his scent. A portrait to show her babies anything. She shivered, waiting. Maggie withdrew a key from her pocket, dangling on a frayed and threadbare ribbon.
"There is a legacy handed down over the centuries at Castle Kelter. It has been the source of many young lasses' romantic dreams."
She arched a brow at her eldest daughter.
"And Colleen here has been the worst."
"Not true. I've heard you and Dad mooning over it tons of times,
and then you both get that disgusting look in your eyes."
"Might I remind you, that disgusting look heralded the advent of your wee life,"
Christopher said dryly.
"Ew!"
Colleen wrinkled her nose again. Maggie laughed and continued.
"Sometimes I think the sheer love of it has blessed all who've ever lived within these walls. The tale was carefully told from generation to generation as they waited for the day to come. Well, the day has arrived, and now the rest is up to you."
Smiling, she handed Gwyn the key.
"It's said you'll know what to do."
"It's said you've done it before,"
Colleen added breathlessly. Perplexed, Gwyn inserted the key with trembling hands. The lock was old and gritty with time, and it took her a few minutes to work the lock. As she opened the door, Christopher handed her a candle.
"There's no electricity in there. The tower hasn't been opened in 5 centuries.
Suspense growing, Gwyn accepted the candle and gingerly stepped into the room, dimly aware that the entire McKelter clan was hot on her heels. It was too dark to see much, but the glow of the candle fell upon a pile of old fabric and the silvery flash of weapons. Drustin's daggers! Her heart lurched painfully. She bent over and fingered the fabric upon which they lay. Tears stung her eyes when she realized it was his plaid, and atop it lay a small pair of black leather trews that would probably be a perfect fit. He'd never forgotten that she'd wanted a pair.
"That's not all,"
Colleen said impatiently.
"That's the least of it. Look up!"
"Colleen,"
Christopher said sternly.
"In her own time, lass."
Blinking back tears, Gwyn glanced up, and as her eyes adjusted completely, she noticed a slab in the center of the circular room. Her heart slammed against her ribs, and she surged to her feet.
"Oh, my God!"
she choked, stumbling toward the slab. It couldn't be. How could it be? She glanced frantically at Maggie, who smiled and nodded encouragingly.
"He waits for you. He's waited 500 years. It is said you know how to wake him."
Gwyn began to hyperventilate. Spots swarmed before her eyes, and she nearly collapsed where she stood. For several moments she could do nothing more than stand there and stare in shock. Then she thrust the black trews she hadn't realized she was clutching at Maggie and scrambled up onto the slab.
"Drustin!"
she cried, raining kisses on his slumbering face.
"Oh, Drustin, my love!"
Tears slipped down her cheeks. How had she awakened him? She wondered frantically, unable to believe that he was really there. She touched him with shaking hands, afraid he might just melt away, afraid she was dreaming.
"I'm not dreaming, am I?"
she whispered weakly.
"No, lass, you're not dreaming,"
Christopher said, smiling. Gwyn stared at Drustin, trying to recall exactly what had happened in the cave. She'd fallen down the ravine and landed squarely on top of him. She'd been fascinated, had touched him, shamelessly running her hands over his chest. Then she'd leaned back so the sun could fall on him, so she might get a better look at the devastating man.
"The sun! You must help me get him outside!" she said urgently. "I think sunlight has something to do with it!"
It took their combined strength to carry the enchanted Highlander down the winding stairs, through the library, and out onto the cobbled terrace. They were huffing by the time they deposited her mighty warrior on the stones. Gwyn stood for a moment, just gaping down at him. Drustan was here. All she had to do was figure out how to wake him. Dazed, she slipped astride him and placed her palms flush to his chest, exactly as she'd done in the cave. The sunshine was falling directly on his face and chest. But nothing happened. The symbols remained, etched clearly upon his chest. Back in the cave, they'd begun disappearing. Why? She narrowed her eyes and peered up at the sun. It was brilliant and clear, a cloudless day. She glanced at Maggie.
"He didn't leave any instructions?"
She needed him awake now. The McKelters shook their heads.
"It was thought he feared someone might wake him before it was time," Maggie said.
She cast Colleen a wry look.
"Like my daughter, who's been infatuated with him since she first peeked through the slit in the tower and saw him slumbering."
Closing her eyes, Gwyn thought hard. What was different? She opened them again slowly and gazed down at his chest. Everything was the same, the sun, the symbols, her hands.
Blood.
There had been blood smeared on the symbols from her cutting her hands up when she'd fallen through the rocks. Could it be that elemental? Human blood and sunshine? She knew nothing about spells, but blood figured prominently in myths and legends.
"I need a knife!"
she cried. Colleen dashed into the castle and returned swiftly, clutching a small steak knife. Mumbling a prayer beneath her breath, Gwyn lightly ran the edge over her palm so drops of blood welled up. With trembling hands, she smeared it across the symbols on his chest, then sat back anxiously, waiting. For a moment, nothing happened. Then, one by one, the symbols began to fade. She sucked in her breath and glanced up at his face.
"Good morrow, English,"
Drustan said lazily, opening his eyes, his silvery gaze tender.
"I knew you could do it, love."
Gwyn's eyelids fluttered, and she fainted. Chapter 28. When Gwyn regained consciousness, she was lying on the bed in the silver chamber. Drustan was bending over her, gazing down with so much love in his eyes that she gasped and began crying.
"Drustan,"
she whispered, clutching at him.
"She's awakened, Maggie," Drustan said over his shoulder. "She's all right."
Gwyn heard the door shut as Maggie left, giving them privacy. She stared up into his silvery eyes wonderingly. He was looking at her as if she were the most precious thing in the world.
"How?"
she managed to ask, cupping his face in her hands. She traced her fingers over every plane and angle, and he kissed them repeatedly as they passed his lips.
"How?"
"I love you, Gwyn McKelter," he whispered, catching her hand and planting a kiss in the palm.
Gwyn laughed through her tears.
"I love you too,"
she whispered back, flinging her arms around him and holding him tightly.
"But I don't understand."
In between dozens of kisses, quick sips, long, leisurely ones, he told her. Told her how he'd watched her disappear as he'd lain on the ground, the battle raging all around. Told her how the arrow had been deflected by the metal disc on his leather bands and had been but a flesh wound. Told her how they discovered who the enemy was.
"That old woman,"
Gwyn murmured.
"She said she'd hired the gypsies."
"Aye, Basetta. She made a full confession."
He kissed her again before continuing, sucking gently on her lower lip.
"Basetta claimed she scried in her eustachs that the woman would bring about the death of her son. Since I was soon to wed, Basetta decided my betrothed must be the woman in her vision. She warned Nevin, but he laughed it off and made her promise not to harm me. To her ailing mind, bespelling me wasn't harming me, so she purchased the gypsy's services to enchant me so she might prevent the wedding. In the first reality, when Anya was killed by the Campbell, Bassetta must have thought the threat had passed. I suspect, however, that sometime shortly after Anya's death, Bassetta must have had her vision again and realized that as long as I was alive and might yet wed, the danger would never pass. So she proceeded with her original plan to have me enchanted.
So she drugged you and sent the message bidding you come to discover the name of the man who'd killed Dacus?
I was enchanted. You found me, and I sent you back.
But in the second reality,
Gwyn exclaimed,
since Dagus and Anya weren't killed, she must have heard you were coming home with your betrothed.
And stepped up plans to have me abducted. Unwilling to take any chances, she wanted my betrothed gone too. As you were in my bedchamber, they assumed you were Anya.
Gwyn shook her head, amazed.
It was her belief in her vision that made everything happen, Drustin. If she hadn't believed in it, she would never have enchanted you. I would never have been sent back, and Nevin would never have given his life to save me.
Aye. 'Tis why the gypsy are o'er-cautious of fortune-telling. They make it clear that any future they scry is but one possible future, the most likely one, yet not writ in stone. For Bassetta, driven by lifelong fear, it was indeed her most probable future. Fear drove her to have me enchanted. Having me enchanted resulted in me sending you back. Once you were there, Nevin gave his life to protect you. Her fear drove her to fulfill the possibility.
Gwyn rubbed her forehead.
This hurts my head.
Drustin laughed.
It hurts mine, too. I'll be most happy to ne'er muck with time again.
Gwyn was silent a moment, thinking.
What happened to Bassetta?
Drustin's eyes darkened.
After you disappeared, she plunged into the battle, and though the men strove not to harm her, she was determined to die. She impaled herself on Robert's claymore. He frowned. She confessed before she died, and we were able to piece the story together.
Fresh tears gathered in Gwyn's eyes.
You would weep for her?
Drustin exclaimed.
If not for her, I should never have found you,
Gwyn said softly.
It's sad. It's sad that she was so afraid. But at the same time, I'm so glad I found you.
He kissed her again, then told her the rest of it. How he'd grieved, how he'd raged, how he'd stormed to the stones and stood arguing with himself for hours. Then his mind had struck upon an idea, so temptingly possible that it had taken his breath away. The gypsies. They'd made him sleep once for 5 centuries, why not again? And so he'd tracked down the wandering tribe and commissioned their services. The gypsy queen herself had performed the spell for a pouch of coin.
For a pouch of coin?
Gwyn exclaimed.
How dare they charge you? They were the ones who...
Who sold a service, nothing more.
The Rome held themselves to a strange code. They maintained that blaming them for Bassetta commissioning them to enchant me would be akin to blaming the blade for drawing blood. 'Tis the hand that wields the dagger, not the dagger itself.
Fine way to evade personal responsibility,
Gwyn grumbled. Then she sucked in a shallow breath.
Your family, Sylvan and Nell and...
He cut her off by kissing her.
My choice was painful to them, but they understood.
He'd not once wavered. He'd spent several months saying his goodbyes before being enchanted, and implementing plans that would bear fruit 5 centuries later, plans to ensure a fine life for him and his wife. But there would be time to tell her of that tomorrow, or the next day, or the next.
They bid me give you their love when we were reunited.
Gwyn got misty-eyed again, then thumped his chest with her fist.
Why didn't you leave instructions for Maggie to find me weeks ago?
She cried.
My heart broke. I've been back for over a month.
I wasn't certain when you would return to your time. I couldn't decide if the month would pass for you in both centuries.
Oh,
she said in a small voice.
And I wasn't willing to take any chances of summoning you before you'd met me. Ugh, but what a finkle that would have been. You wouldn't have known how to wake me. You wouldn't have even known me if we'd sent for you too early. Seems safer to let you come.
But what if I hadn't come? What if I'd never come back to Scotland?
I left instructions that if you hadn't arrived by Samhain, my descendants should find you and bid you come. They were to look for you in America and bring you here.
But...
Are you going to talk me to death or kiss me, wife? He asked huskily. She opted for the kiss.
When his lips claimed hers, her body quickened with desire. He paused only to strip off his linen shirt while Gwyn made short work of his plaid.
Lay back,
she commanded when she had him completely naked.
I think I should like to be on top.
He complied, flashing her a sexy grin that dripped promises of fantasies about to be fulfilled. She sat back on her heels, gazing at him, sprawled across the bed. His bronze skin and silky dark hair gleamed against the white linens. 6.5 feet of Highland warrior lay before her, awaiting her pleasure.
Yum.
Years of not understanding the equation of life culminated in one perfect moment of clarity. Life equaled love plus passion squared. Loving and being passionate about what one did was what made life so precious. She would be perfectly content to devote the rest of her life to the proof of that equation.
Touch me, he purred.
She touched, lightly, gliding her hands up his muscular thighs, tracing each muscle, each ridge, then lowering her head to taste in her hand's wake. She cupped him and swept her tongue up the underside of his hard shaft, delighted when he bucked beneath her.
Gwendolyn! He thundered, cradling her head with his hands. I will not last a minute if you do that.
Och name a brawlaird,
she said in a lilting Scots accent.
Be still, 'tis my pleasure you serve.
Ah!
She burst into laughter when in one swift motion he rolled her onto her back.
I bid you recall I've been needing you for 500 years, whereas you've been waiting only a month.
Yes, but you didn't know time was past,
she began, but he kissed her words away. He covered her body with his own, sliding her shirt up, kissing each breast as he bared them, alternately returning for a searing kiss to her lips, then moving lower. When at last he buried himself inside her, he groaned with ecstasy. He'd have waited 1,000 years, nay, eternity, to have this woman as his own. Much later, Druston held her in his arms, marveling at how she completed him. She'd had her way and had the top, the third time, informing him he was her own private playground, then explaining what a playground was. He had much to learn to fully integrate himself into her century. He suffered no fear on that score, rather was exhilarated by the challenge. Emotion flooded him, a sense of rightness and completion, and he kissed her, putting all his joy into the kiss. He was surprised when she pulled away, but then she took his hand and gently placed his palm over her belly. He shot straight up in bed, searching her eyes.
Are you telling me something?
He exclaimed hoarsely.
Twins. We're having twins,
she said, bubbling over with joy.
And you waited till now to tell me?
He roared, then threw his head back and whooped. He swept her into his arms and danced her about the room. He twirled her, kissed her, danced her more, then stopped and gently placed her back on the bed.
I shouldn't be tossing you about like that, he exclaimed.
Gwyn laughed.
Oh, please. If our loving didn't jostle them, a little dance certainly won't hurt. I'm a little over 2 months along.
2 months!
He shouted, leaping to his feet again. Gwyn beamed. He was so elated. It was what every woman should get to experience when she told her man she was pregnant, a man utterly ecstatic to be a father. He stood grinning like a fool for a moment, then sobered and dropped to his knees before her.
Will you be wedding me in a church, Gwendolyn?
I. Oh, I?
Gwyn sighed dreamily. And this time when they made love, it was tender and slow and sweeter than e'er before.
Where will we live?
she asked finally, combing her fingers through his silky hair. She simply couldn't stop touching him, couldn't believe he was here, couldn't believe the sacrifice he'd made to be with her. He grinned.
I took care of that. The estate was divided into thirds in 1518. My third is to the south. Dagus oversaw the construction of our home. It awaits us even now. Maggie and Christopher assured me they opened it and all is in readiness.
Dagus, Gwyn thought. She needed to tell him about Dagus vanishing, but there would be time for that later. She didn't want anything to spoil the moment.
You do not mind living in Scotland, do you, lass?
He teased lightly, but she sensed a hint of vulnerability in his question. It would be hard for him to adjust to a new century. It would be even more difficult if she dragged him off to America. In time, she suspected he would like to travel, for he was a curious man, but Scotland would always be his home. Which was fine. She had no desire to go back to the States. The enormity of what he'd done, how much he'd given up for her, overwhelmed her.
Trustin, she breathed. You gave it all up.
He pulled her onto his chest and brushed his lips against hers.
And I would do it all over again, sweet Gwyn.
But your family, your century, your home.
Oh, class, don't you know, your heart is my home.
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Kiss of the Highlander by Karen Marie Mauning. Copyright 2001 by Karen Marie Mauning. Read by Phil Giganti. Directed by Laura Grafton. Engineered by Chris Kessel. Performance copyright 2007 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brilliancedaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.